Hello, and thank you for joining us. Welcome to the CHIME Opioid Action Center podcast, where we explore how healthcare technology and healthcare IT leaders are making an impact in the fight against the opioid crisis. Please welcome today's moderator.
Hello, I'm Bill Spooner of the CHIME Opioid Task Force. A number of community initiatives extending beyond the traditional hospital walls have brought great interest from the Appalachian Highlands Regional Opioid Task Force, on which I also serve, as it works to combat substance abuse in Northeast Tennessee and Southwest Virginia. Today, we are speaking with Monty Burks of the Tennessee Department of Health. He's the director of the Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services. So to get started, Monty, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, your connection to the Appalachian Highlands, et cetera, how you grew into this role?
Absolutely. Well, Bill, thank you again for inviting me to speak on this podcast, and thank you for you know opening the door to share some information about treatment and recovery. I've been in this role for about a little bit over seven years. I'm the director of faith-based initiatives at the Tennessee Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services. My job is to connect our faith communities to the recovery system, to the recovery support system, to the behavioral health care system. That's mental health and substance abuse services. The reason that I'm in this role is because of my past and my lived experience. And when I say reason, it was the driving force behind me pushing forward in this piece of my career. I come from the criminal justice background. Most of my professional career was in criminal justice, but I've always been a person that's really been attracted to working with the behavioral healthcare system. I have lived experience. I'm a person that's in long-term recovery from substance abuse and a mental health diagnosis. March 3rd, I'll celebrate 21 years. I'm a little preemptive there, but I'll celebrate 21 years free from substance use disorder, free from the negative things that happened to me in my life, all of the barriers, all of the bondage, all of the strongholds that almost overcame me and destroyed me. And that's why I'm in this role. That's the driving force. That's the passion behind my purpose. During my early struggles, I was a person that needed help. I needed to reach out to community. I needed community, and I didn't really know where to go. And I was able to find my recovery process, my recovery path, through the help of some ladies at one of the local churches in Middle Tennessee. They understood the recovery community. They understood how to connect people to resources. And this was, again, way before we're having the conversations that we're having right now. I was just blessed. You know, it was a divine timing, divine intervention that God allowed some people in my life from the church, from the local churches that knew of a local support group, support meeting, and they were able to get me to that meeting, and that meeting was able to get me to community. Now, just a quick shout off of that, I was able to connect through, you know, I'd gotten myself in a lot of mess during those times in my life. As Bill, as you and I both know, as professionals, that people that suffer from long-term addiction, we have a lot of casualties along the way, and most of the time, the casualties are ourselves. I managed to get myself in all kinds of mess and all kinds of troubles, and I was given an opportunity to go to treatment through criminal justice intervention. Through that access point to get myself into treatment, I was able to get out of treatment, connect back with that faith community, have the community that I needed to move forward and to walk in my recovery process. How I'm connected to the Appalachians and all of the areas up in East Tennessee that connect all of our in our beautiful state is when I came into this role, I was assigned to work over a project called Project Lifeline. I was formerly a Project Lifeline coordinator before I worked in state government. But what Project Lifeline does is they're boots on the ground to be able to connect communities to the behavioral health care system and to reduce the stigma related to the disease of addiction and also for mental health issues. We have Lifeliners that are in the East Tennessee area that serve all in those wonderful, beautiful counties up in our mountainous tips. And I was able to connect with them, connect with the faith community, connect with our treatment providers, connect with the team that you work with to try to figure out how to connect more recovery supports to already existing recovery support agencies, our treatment agencies, our hospitals, our recovery support programs, our ministries. We wanted to be able to be the glue that connected everyone together and connected everyone together. So I actually oversee that project now that I formerly worked in. And there are 17 lifeliners across the state, and their job is to get in those gap areas and pull everybody together so there won't be as many gap areas. So I've been in this role for over 7 years and been able to connect the dots. I've met some wonderful people, including Dr. Randy Jesse in the East Tennessee area, who has been nothing but a great leader and mentor, if you will, in the work that I do. He understands the there's a bigger picture when we talk about working with community engagement. With that, Bill, I'll hand it back over to you because I know that we have some questions to answer, but I hope I gave kind of an eye shot of what I do.
That's really great, and I appreciate the overview. So you described that you really were helped early on by a church group, and at some point you realized that you could make that you could expand that across other clergy organizations and expand it through the state. And why don't you tell us how you got that started and how it grew? Because I remember when you spoke to us a couple of years ago, you had reached to many church groups across the state of Tennessee.
So what we've done is that, my awesome and wonderful Commissioner Marie Williams, when she pulled me into this role, she was then the deputy. We had a Commissioner Doug Varney, which is actually from the East Tennessee area. They recruited me in and brought me in to this role with the specific job to target working with our faith communities. The progeny of that work is one, the lifeliners, and two, the faith-based coordinators. What we've been able to do over the course of these last few years is connect with thousands of clergy to have the conversation around addiction, to reimagine the conversation around addiction, community support, to remove the language of moral failing and immoral decency, and start looking at people as people so we can serve people using person first, people first language. So when doing this through and with our faith-based initiative, we went out across the state. We have three faith-based coordinators on top of the 17 lifeliners. The faith-based coordinators each serve one of Tennessee's grand divisions. So what their job is to recruit and train congregations on how to be recovery friendly. When the congregations become recovery friendly, if they want to work with us, then we recognize them from state government through state government as a certified recovery congregation. And what that means is we want to make sure that they have access to resources, access to other things that can help them in the ministry work they do in the communities. And also they can be connected with other ministries in their community, which means if we're talking to thousands of clergy across the state, we want to make sure that they know each other exists. There's 21 of us. There's over 12,000 different faith and religious institutions in Tennessee. The faith and religious institutions are the oldest, largest demographic that we have in this state, and it's also the largest demographic we have in this country. So to deny the power in the pews of our sanctuaries is a significant part in the recovery process would be to deny the truth. So our team, we go out and we reach out to our congregations and we do needs assessments and we work closely with them to figure out, hey, listen, recovery friendly doesn't mean you have to start a meeting. It just means you know where the resources are when somebody comes to you that needs those resources. So the 3-man congregation can shift people to a meeting. The 30,000 people congregation may have a meeting. The 1,300 people congregation may have a feeding ministry, et cetera, et cetera. And then connecting all of those together is how we were able to acquiesce across the state, almost like a snowball that goes back and forth that just gains size and momentum as it moves. The goal, over 12,000 congregations to be recovery friendly. That would be the most awesome goal that we could ever dream of. The reality behind it is all congregations are not going to be able to work in this capacity with respect to their beliefs, their denominations, their different views. I love and respect that. We still try to connect with everyone, get them trained on everything, understanding mental health, understanding what treatment is, understanding the difference between treatment and recovery, understanding the addicted brain, understanding the brain chemistry change in the process and what it takes for a person to recover. Bill, you would be amazed at how many clergy have now went through the ACEs training, Building Strong Brains, Mental Health 101, understanding how the addiction process works and understanding how long-term community support is what keeps people clean, connect them to community. The opposite of addiction is connection. It's relationship. Addiction equals isolation. People isolate themselves when they have those issues, and it keeps them away from community, and community is the process That's part of the process to heal. Again, everybody heals differently. There is no one prescribed method for a person to find their freedom. But what we want to do is make sure that we explore every avenue, have every community ready, because, you know, Bill, as a professional, it could always be our son or our daughter or our sister or our brother or even us or even our parents that need this community-based support. So the more people that get involved, we're not looking to tell anybody what to do. We're only giving them tools to do what they do better.
That is fascinating. My next question is around what the typical church's program looks like. Is there a typical program? Or is there a lot of variety? Just describe that for me for a minute.
Well, so it's actually, there's a lot of variety. So depending on, you know, you have churches, you have synagogues, you have mosques, you have all of these different entities that are faith driven. And so the programs are going to be culturally competent to that belief or to that sanctuary or to that denomination. So you could have anything from a Celebrate Recovery, which is very popular in the Christian tradition. I actually attended a bunch of Celebrate Recoveries. I volunteer at my church in recovery ministry work, and in the Christian community, Celebrate Recovery is very, very popular. And you have other faith traditions that love Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous. Each of those are different offsets of the 12-step model, with Celebrate Recovery being one that's fit mainly toward the Christian perspective, where AA and NA are geared toward anybody that comes in on any level for whatever purpose they come in for. And then you have Cocaine Anonymous, Methamphetamine Anonymous, Marijuana Anonymous, Pornography Anonymous, Gambling Anonymous. How this connects with our churches and our congregations and our other houses of worship is, one, Bill, that every one of our congregations operates in its own space, which means that what may work in Henry County might not work in Johnson County and probably won't work in Shelby County. So each of those congregations are going to be culturally competent, not only to the people that are in the four walls of their sanctuary, also to the area of their community. You may not need a Cocaine Anonymous in Washington County, but you may need a Methamphetamine Anonymous in Stewart County. You know, all of the, there's so our coordinators and our trainers work with our pastors, our clergy, our leaders, and it isn't always pastors. It isn't always rabbis. It isn't always imams. It isn't always the leadership. Sometimes it's the first lady, the second or third person in command. Sometimes it's an eldest deacon or leader. Sometimes it's just a community volunteer that's knocking at your door saying, hey, we need support here. But those meetings tend to look like what the community needs. So whatever the community needs is what the support meeting usually is, the niche that it's trying to fill or the niche that it's trying to follow. So sometimes recovery support, Bill, is a clothing ministry or a feeding ministry. It's not necessarily a 12-step. It's not necessarily a meeting setting where people share stories. It may be a situation where someone has every Saturday, they open the doors of their sanctuary and people donate clothes and food and people that need it come by. A lot of people that get out of treatment go back to their communities and they burned every single bridge possible to help them. So the community isn't as quickly to forgive the things that they've done before. But it's incumbent on us as people of faith, and it's commissioned upon us to open our doors and to try to figure out how to fill those gaps so we can get people to a better place. So that's where food comes in, clothes comes in, toiletries come in, counseling comes in, transportation comes in. Some of our congregations across the state, Bill, have job readiness training that they do with people in their community. They do resume writing. And again, this is why recovery support is so important, because recovery support doesn't look any certain way. It looks like everything. It could literally just be people giving someone a ride to the doctor. How can you expect someone to walk in a recovery process when they're not healthy? How can we expect a person to maintain their sobriety if they're not getting food, they're hungry? How can we expect a person to not revert to an old lifestyle if they don't have clothes to put on their children's back? So that's why this is what the progeny of all of that is. All of these wonderful communities are starting to see these different pieces of the puzzle that they can provide. And that's where recovery support comes in.
Fascinating. Well, that really leads probably to my next question quite well, looking at a different dimension. There are multiple perspectives, as you know, Monty, on the efficacy of different programs. Medication, medication assisted, no medication, AA and AA-like 12-step programs. Where does a typical faith-based counseling program fit in the alternatives? Do they support all methods? Do they favor medication-assisted treatment typically or not? Okay. What does that look like around the state?
So throughout the state, I'll be honest with you, Bill, we actually have support meetings called MARA, Medicated Assisted Recovery Anonymous. I'm pretty sure you may not have been familiar with that. The MARA groups and the training around the MARA groups have really been good for our communities of faith. Because, you know, sometimes we don't understand the significance of a person that has to take medication to assist them in their treatment process and in their recovery. So how it looks is we support from where I'm at in my department, we support access to medication for treatment, access to medication for recovery. So when we train, we always train our community leaders and liaisons on, listen, this is what medication does. This is what it's for. This is the long-term effects of a person that takes medication, and this is their process. Everybody doesn't need medication. That's not my call. I don't have that authority. I'm not a therapist. I'm not a counselor. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a prescriber. But I can tell you, as a person that's in long-term recovery, that we don't want to take options off the table for other people, because then that puts us, we go from being empathetic to being trying to walk in somebody else's shoes and tell them what to do. So each individual case is different. What we want our congregations to know that if we don't understand medicated assisted treatment, how about we bring a doctor in and allow our clergy to have a Q&A session with an MAT doctor? Dr. Stephen Lloyd and myself traveled the state together years ago and met with clergy all across the state. And he explained the process of the addicted brain. And then he explained how medicated assisted treatment works in allowing a person's brain time to heal so they can get on with their recovery. You would be amazed, Bill, at how many hundreds of clergy showed up to those meetings with a pen and pad because they wanted to know what MAT was, how it worked, if they supported it or not. They at least wanted to know, you know, what it was, you know, and that's kind of a gap that we've been trying to fill with our faith-based coordinators, is they're all trained on how to explain the concepts around MAT. How it's important to, if you don't agree with MAT, at least don't push a person away from something that might give them the opportunity to heal. I'm a person, Bill, I've survived 2.5 heart attacks. I take medication, I take heart medication. I have chronic hypertension and I have some genetic issues that I can't, there's nothing I'm gonna be able to do about it other than maintain my position for the rest of my life so I can live to be a glorious seasoned saint to do great work even when my feet and hands fail me. But I'm also going to have to take medication for the rest of my life. And I know that. And the concept is the same with MAT. Sometimes people may take it for 3 weeks. They may take it for 3 months. They may take it for 30 years. But they're alive. And they're our family member. And that's our son. And that's our daughter.
Wow. Thank you. But I'm guessing the answer. But my question is, is there any way to predict whether I would need a person, an individual would need medication or not?
That would be an individualized assessment between you and the person that you connect with your treatment provider. That's not something that I could even remotely answer. Okay. Everybody's case is different. Every single person's case is different. I will tell you this, that on the backside of that, connecting to community coupled with whatever the assessment yields, is a process that people go through, you know, so there's no way that I could answer that because it's gonna be different for me, it's gonna be different for you, it's gonna be different for Amy, it's gonna be different for John, and it's gonna be different for Jill. A lot of it depends on, you know, there's a lot of other circumstances, there's bio, psycho, social, and spiritual, all these things play into part in a person's recovery process, access to resources as well.
So you've described with great clarity, the value that your program has brought in terms of engaging the community. But I'm still curious a little bit as to what really convinced the state of Tennessee to initiate such a program, to fund such a program, recognize the critical nature of the work that you are doing?
Well, so let's look at it. Let's look at it from a pure numbers perspective, Bill. We have, if you and I, we work in different institutions that are older institutions. Faith communities, their institutions have been around longer than any other institution in our state, as well as in our country. They're established entities. There are over 12,000 faith and religious institutions in our state. That includes treatment agencies that are faith-based, recovery programs that are faith-based, and our churches, congregations, mosques, synagogues, other houses of worship, over 12,000. Now let's look at the number of people that need help. We have 6.7 million Tennesseans, almost 3.6 million Tennesseans attend congregational services of some sort every week. That is a large demographic to have a powerful, strong, consistent message around the conversation of recovery. There are over 3,000 people of faith per person who died of suicide and overdose death in 2019. That means 3,000 people per one person who died of a suicide-related death and an overdose-related death in 1 year. It only took one or two people to help me in my process. We got 3,000 people per one. So you can look at that from those numbers and see the significance and the importance of having a faith-based initiative, if for nothing else, to get resources to our faith community. Because Bill, I'm going to be honest with you. I work in my job. There's me, and then there's my team. But 3.6 million people with the same message around addiction, treatment, and recovery, there's no way that the power that we have in our faith community to be out on the front lines is unreal. It's unfathomable. So our job is, we're going to try to do that. And until my day is done, until I'm called home, I'm going to continue to encourage my pastors, my clergy, and other people that work in other different state departments and state government to connect the dots. Because when we don't connect, we're serving Tennesseans two different ways to serve them. Our faith community serve our Tennesseans from a faith and a spiritual perspective. Our state government serves people from a different perspective. The problem is or the past problem might have been that we're serving the same people. We don't have to do it separately. Our job is to make sure people stay alive, have access to resources. And again, we live in the great volunteer state, mighty Tennessee, ranked 10th in the United States for numbers of congregations per person. We've got work to do, and we're going to continue to do it.
So, and you, as you talk with your boss, are there metrics that you report to demonstrate program success, or is it general word of mouth? What designates the success to your boss?
We have the number of, we have a few metrics that we keep. One is the number of congregations that we train, the number of clergy that we connect with, the number of people that are referred to treatment and recovery resources from the faith-based initiative. And we also have the number of congregations that we've been able to certify over the course of these years. Those are all metrics that we keep. I will tell you that in the last quarter of last year, we were able to connect with about 500 different clergy through trainings, separate clergy through trainings around question, persuade, refer, QPR, mental health first aid, the addicted brain, sexual addiction and compulsion. We were able to do these trainings and have that many clergy jump on the trainings. We were able to refer hundreds of people into treatment, recovery, housing, and other supportive services. And the majority of those are coming straight from the pews of our sanctuaries. So yes, we do keep metrics and we track those metrics.
Well, this is an incredible story, but switching gears just a little bit. As you know, there have been many reports about an increasing incidence of overdose since the COVID pandemic began. I'm wondering what you see statewide. How have you been able to respond, especially with social distancing and the fact that you aren't able to do as much in-person work? How have you deployed virtual programming in your arena?
That's a good question. One of the things that our faith communities have done is they've had to adapt to COVID to be able to still serve their communities. So what we did, our faith-based coordinators, they were able to reach out through our champions. We have a lot of congregations and faith leaders that we work with. So we were able to reach out to them so they could reach out to other clergy and other people of faith to share information about resources, about the 1-800-TN Redline, about the crisis number, 741 crisis. We were able to get the information out through our channels to get people back to resources. We knew with COVID, we weren't going to be able to step foot in the same places all the time. But what we did know is that we could utilize our base of faith-based providers, volunteers, and all of our wonderful champions to get the message out and to connect people to resources. And what that means is when we have trainings, we bring in practitioners and other peers that may do a Narcan training online to our faith-based partners. We've been able to do that with the regional overdose prevention specialists, which are actually ran out of the Division of Prevention Services out of my department. Anthony Jackson is the director. He and I have partnered together, and they do naloxone trainings online for clergy and people in the community, and they still distribute naloxone in the communities for people to come and get once they've went through the training. This is just one way that we can be able to address. Another thing is we have to talk about addiction. So we have to keep the constant conversation going around what to look for, what questions to ask, how to around suicide prevention and intervention, you know, question, persuade, refer, assist, all of these different modules, these trainings that our coordinators will provide them. And their job every day is to reach out into all of our 6.7 million Tennesseans in any way they can and to have conversations. And even though sometimes the conversations are uncomfortable, we can leave that conversation knowing one is that people know they're not alone. Two, it's okay to not be okay. And three, there is help out there. Here are the numbers, here are the websites, and here's our phone number. So that's how we've had to address it. We're a mere piece in a much bigger puzzle. So we work with as many providers and advocates and champions as possible. So hopefully even with this podcast, somebody's going to listen to this and reach back around and call me, email me, text me and say, hey, we would love to get some trainings out to our community because we're dealing with these issues. And you better believe, Bill, I'm going to be jumping on top of that and sending our faith-based coordinators and our lifeliners to do it.
So what's next for the program?
What's next for the program is post, as we gear toward, as COVID, we start to reacclimate to community, we're going to go dig deeper, dive harder into working with our communities of faith around mental health. We're going to have a lot of conversations around mental health because we're in an unknown era right now. Bill, as you and I we both know that, you know, we've not ever dealt with a national pandemic like this. We've not had to deal with issues like this. So we want to make sure that our communities of faith know what resources are available, know what new resources are available, or how they can ask the right questions and maybe connect people to other resources. Listen, you don't have to have a PhD or a DD or an MD or anything to just give someone a hug or to love someone and to connect them to another resource. So that's what's next for the initiative, is to stay on top of it, to keep moving forward. All of the champions that we work with to make sure that they stay involved with the behavioral healthcare system in some capacity. Make sure that whatever trainings they need, let us get those trainings to them. And lastly, Tennessean, as a man of devout faith, I think it's incumbent on me and you as well, Bill, to continue the work we do because we were gifted to live through this thing, and we need to make sure that we're out here serving to the best of our capacity, my friend.
I certainly agree, Monty, and this has been a great conversation. You mentioned call me, text me. If people would like to learn more, how do they reach you?
They can reach me. My email is MONTY.BURKS, monty.burks@tn.gov. They can call me at 615-308-3163. 615-308-3163. That is my cell phone number and my email. I look forward to anyone that needs to call to talk about some of these amazing resources or be able to connect the dots. Also, if you can hear me and you are of resource, we would like to partner with you. Even if it's something as simple as providing soup to people in a recovery meeting. Listen, it takes a lot for people sometimes to be vulnerable and come to a meeting. If you're a person that just has some free time on your hands and you want to be part of the recovery community, please reach out to me and let me connect you to the resources in your community. The more people that are willing to be part of this, the better we'll do it in helping our Tennesseans.
Well, Monty, this has been really inspiring. I really appreciate the time that you've spent with us. We will be sharing this podcast through Spotify and a number of other social media, and I'm certain it will have an impact. So I thank you very, very much.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Bill. Thank you for having me on here.